Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Kumar Gupta is currently the Senior Departmental Advisor in the Office of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, or OMINA, as many of us better know it, where he is in the thick of all of our important foreign policy files. But he began his career working on development, working with prominent Canadian NGOs in South America. Along the way, he became an Africanist with postings in Ethiopia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, where he served as head of mission until 2017. He recently stopped by my office to talk about his work in Africa, his experience in the department as a visible minority, and what it's like to work in a minister's office. Kumar Gupta, it is great to see you. You're looking remarkably relaxed on the back end of some holidays. Totally unfair.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here this morning in a gorgeous mid-July, perfect summer day.
I was looking at your background and your CV, and I noticed you seem to have lived all over Canada, born in Montreal, educated at Queen's and in Calgary, but even before that you had lived in Edmonton and Moncton. What's the deal? Where are the Guptas from?
Well, I'd like to say that I planned ahead and did a cross-Canada tour before joining the department, but it was not quite so systematic. My father used to work for CN Rail, so the missing factor on most of that is their railway hubs. I was born in Montreal, where my dad and my mom and I should say emigrated.
From where?
From India, yeah. In the 1960s. And then we moved to Edmonton, another railway hub, and then Moncton, which was also a railway hub.
And you told me your dad was an engineer, but it took you a while to figure out he didn't actually drive the trains.
That is indeed true. Of course, if you work for the railways, the engineer is sort of a double-used term.
Right. So you go off and become an engineer with a strong commitment to the environment and the NGO sector. Talk to us about those early decisions you made and where they took you.
Well, I always found science and engineering interesting, so it's a very natural career path. However, as I made my way through undergrad, I became involved with an NGO, a Queens-based NGO, Queen's University, Queen's Project on International Development, which sent a range of students, principally engineering students, to Guyana and Bolivia to, and I'm doing, I'll say, quote, help the locals. In actual fact, we went there to learn, and that one rapidly figured that out. And that's where I learned that there are bigger questions in the world than, you know, developing the next soap, the best soap for Procter & Gamble. And so at that stage, there was a shift away from the technical side, more towards the policy side and the international side.
And, I mean, you've had a great career. You've kind of become an Africanist. You've been a head of mission. You're currently in the minister's office, and I want to get to some of those topics. But did you, was it always going to be, after the NGO sector, did you always have your sights set on foreign affairs, or was it a... Did you look at other options?
Well, in fact, in between my undergrad and master's, I spent a couple years working with World University Service of Canada, mm-hmm. WUSC, in Peru on water supply and sanitation projects. And out of that came a commitment and passion to development and the civil society side of the house. Mm-hmm. So in actual fact, government was not really in the cards until later. And you're correct in saying I've done a number of posts with the department in Africa, so there's an African element. But I would say that I also have a commitment to Latin America as another interesting part of the world.
What was the process that led you to write the Foreign Service Exam, and where did you write it?
It was the process, and I see this in a lot of younger colleagues, of many unsuccessful applications, you know, just a word to our folks and colleagues who are with us, it is very normal. I kept all my applications to refer back once I got callbacks, of which I got none. And it was 1.5 to 2 inches.
And you're applying to NGOs and to other places to work and not having any success.
The usual stuff, CUSO, CARE, Oxfam. I spoke multiple languages. I'd worked abroad for a few years. And so it was very disheartening. And unfortunately, that is natural in the nature of this process. So eventually I said, okay, I'm going to write the Foreign Service exam. And again, more quotes out of why not? I'll write the exam. And I wrote the exam in Moncton, where my parents were living at the time. And it was interesting because there was 3 people in the room that I wrote in. And subsequently, colleagues in the department who wrote it, you know, in larger, you know, Vancouver or Montreal, Toronto, said that typically there was a couple hundred people.
Right.
So very different dynamic, I think.
Yeah. I wrote it in London also with a massive room full of people. But our trajectories are a little bit the same. I was sort of captivated by Africa following my undergrad and applied to every entity I could think of. And I still have all of the rejection letters. So I ended up in graduate school.
At least they were kind enough to send you rejection letters.
I recently came across a pamphlet that CETA had put out in those days called Looking for Work in International Development to help people just like myself. And I never was never successful. Anyhow, you joined the Foreign Service, and because of your deep commitment to Africa and your interest in Latin America, they sent you to New York.
So much for the best laid of plans. Although it's interesting, one of my mentors told me, you have a commitment to development, learning about Africa, you're going to learn so much about these issues in New York. And he was absolutely right. You know, I mean, from a diplomatic perspective, I don't want to say New York is the center of the world, but many issues transit through there. And it was an enormous learning opportunity. Mm.
And how long were you there?
4 years.
Since then, there's been a number of headquarters incarnations, but you have been to Ethiopia working on the African Union, London, where you were involved in public affairs, and then I want you to talk to us about the pathway that led you to become the head of a one Canadian office in Zambia.
I wouldn't say it was such a deliberate pathway. It was a new office that the Africa branch had decided to downsize the embassies in Rwanda and Zambia to one person offices, and it was a remarkable experience. It was the true one Canadian, 4 Zambians, and probably a similar configuration in Rwanda. And I have to say that professionally, that was an amazing experience.
You were how many years into the department?
That was about 10 or 11 years.
And you're a head of mission or head of office at that? I don't know.
Yeah, it was an FS3 position, head of office, and I had a head of mission in Tanzania, one country over. But you wind up doing everything. I'm a political officer by origins, as it were. And you learn consular administration, trade, as well as, of course, the bread and butter of your political trade. And there's no such thing as that's such an eye-opening experience. And also, quite frankly, every single diplomat in that country was my counterpart. It's a lot of fun.
Right, right. And then you were transferred next door to Zimbabwe as head of mission.
Well, the opportunity arose, and for my, quote, sins, they identified that as a worthwhile opportunity, a good fit. And it was really another incredible experience. It was, I should say, culturally, Zambia and Zimbabwe are similar. They're not identical, but they're similar. And so it was a very logical continuation of that Southern Africa experience. It was also the very different experience in that in Zambia, we have enormous, enormous commercial interests. Our mining interests in that country are in the billions. In Zimbabwe, it's a very different relationship. At that time, it was the waning days of the Mugabe regime. So it was not, of which we were very critical and very concerned about rule of law, good governance, democracy, that those kinds of issues. So it was, and we had and still have sanctions against senior members of that regime. So, of course, it was not exactly...
it's not a linear progression from...
Not in that sense.
Yeah. But we do have a historic relationship with Zimbabwe, I think. And I must say there are few modern case studies that, strike one as so tragic, frankly, as the downward trajectory of that country. Talk to us about what it was like when you lived there and how the transition that is now happening came about.
On the one hand, Zimbabweans are wonderful, wonderful people. And you can't, that, of course, will put a smile on your face every single day. On the other hand, you see how they've been mistreated, the experiences they have. And one of my colleagues in the mission, one of our local staff, she has two daughters. I won't name any names, of course. One is a teenager and one is maybe four or five now. Mm-hmm. And it's a very typical scenario that she had made plans for her teenage daughter to essentially get out of Zimbabwe, study abroad, and build a life somewhere else. She had not made such plans for her younger daughter because she was, well, you know what? Things will have changed by then. And then she started to make plans for her second daughter. And that was, it was a very poignant and upsetting conversation for me. I also remember at one stage we were in rural Zimbabwe seeing a humanitarian program for Zimbabweans who were suffering from malnutrition. And there was a woman in the village, like a village elder, she's probably 60, and my goodness, she spoke magnificent English. Long, just such a rich vocabulary. If I ever have to play Scrabble, I want her on my team. And then at one stage, the chaperone asked her to speak the local language, which is fine. But what struck me is that this woman lived in rural Zimbabwe. She would have been educated decades ago, and yet she had this incredible, incredible vocabulary and command of English. And what really was upsetting is when I was in Harare, days later, I'd interact with the youth, and they didn't have the same
vocabulary.
That's concerning.
So a thing that I've always puzzled on... I mean, I know the stock answer, but I want your answer. The thing that I've puzzled on is the regional or continental posture toward Zimbabwe in all of the years, in all of its difficult years. And I note that with Venezuela, a country with which I'm personally much more familiar, and the coming into being of the Lima Group, that was really the neighboring countries saying, enough. We will not, despite Latin American solidarity, we will not tolerate what the government is doing to the people of Venezuela, and so we're going to isolate. In the case of Zimbabwe, that never really happened, and I know the stock answer is because of the esteem with which President Mugabe was held because of his contribution to the independence struggle. Do you have any reflections on that question and what it says about the country or the region or leadership?
Well, one thing that crosses my mind is that Zimbabwe is a very, very young country compared to some of those countries in South America that are, in fact, older than Canada. If you, on average, many of the countries of Africa got independence in the 60s, maybe the 70s. Zimbabwe in 1980, very, very late. And if you consider the lifting of apartheid, independence, South Africa 1994, and Namibia in 1990. So these are very, very young countries. And some of them, I don't want to say all, but some of them, especially in the SADC region, have a similar history of liberation from
colonial.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a common narrative. And I think, and this is speculation, because I'm obviously more familiar with Zimbabwe than some of the neighboring countries. There's a commonality of situation historically. I think, you know, how they've dealt with it currently, the current situation is certainly not identical, not common. So I suspect that they said, well, Robert Mugabe is the last living liberation leader on the continent, which is technically not true, but one of the most vocal. That is the esteem, but also we all had our liberation leaders and we would never treat our leaders in a similar way.
Sure.
But
sure.
It also relates to a common political context.
Right. Absolutely. Ethiopia, Zambia, Zimbabwe, any particular experience that stands out as the most rewarding?
I would say in Zambia, we had three foci. One was child marriage. Number two was the rights of gay and lesbian persons. And lastly was our commercial interest in the country. And certainly the one that meant the most to me was the child marriage issues. Mm. And when you would meet a former child bride, they would talk about their experiences. It was heartbreaking when
harrowing,
you first, but then this is a person who has escaped that situation, is hopefully rebuilding her life. There's hope, there's optimism, but it made me think of how important that work is.
Right. Every now and again, we do get those human interactions that kind of reinforce why we signed up in the first place. I think it's probably fair to say those are fewer in Ottawa than they are at the pointy end of the organization. But I remember the same kinds of personal experiences from my time in Cuba a long time ago. I want to shift now, Kumar, and talk about your experience in the department as a visible minority. More and more common, but perhaps not quite so common when you joined. And has being a visible minority shaped, or how has it shaped your experience at Global Affairs?
That's a tough question, because obviously being a visible minority is inherent to who I am.
Right.
And so it's inherent to how I've been shaped, and it's an ongoing process, of course. One element that I find kind of interesting is that my very first assignment was our permanent mission to New York, Permany. And it was myself, and we have every year, of course, the junior advisors, which is five or six of people who joined, friends who joined around the same time. And it was amazing. We had myself, another officer of Vietnamese origin, a colleague and friend of St. Lucian origin. One of the other officers was of Cree origin. It goes on and on.
Right.
Literally, behind the Canada desk, it was a lot of perplexity. That's Canada? And that brought me a lot of pride, because yes, that is Canada.
Right. And you told me a story once about your presentation of credentials in Zimbabwe, where there was a bit of a mistaken identity.
Indeed, I had just presented credentials to Robert Mugabe, as of course is the norm. And the custom there is you will step outside of the meeting or whatever, and you do a short statement to the media. And of course, the media immediately turned to the political counselor, thinking he was the new head of mission. And he very politely ushered them in my direction and set them straight. But that was wonderful. It set a great tone that this is the Canada.
This is the face of Canada, face of Canadian diplomacy. We're pushing up on time, but I do want to ask you about your current job, which is in the minister's office, Minister Freeland's office, up on the 10th floor. Many of us wonder what it's like to work there day in, day out. You've been doing it for a year, 1 year, just on. You can't see because it's a podcast, but there was a 1 year gesture that Kumar made. What's been your greatest surprise about working within the minister's office? What's different?
I think I won't say it's a surprise, but a very stark reminder. There's the very classic truism that is presented to, I'll say, young officers, but to all of us: fearless advice and loyal implementation. And really, the rubber hits the pavement in the minister's office in that context. It's so very important that we do provide our best advice to the minister's office. And of course, once we have a decision from the minister, we implement. And what you see, or what I'm seeing that is maybe an additional context from previous jobs, is the challenges that the minister and her team have in assessing, not this challenge of assessing the advice, of course they can do that, but in the context of weighing the options and the consequences, there's some decisions that are very easy, and that's fine. That's not why any of us earn the big bucks, especially them. But then there are many decisions that are not easy. There are many decisions that, you know, it's a menu of bad choices. And we will provide that menu, and not because we enjoy it, but because that's the world we live in. And we do, of course, provide the frank advice around the consequences of each of those choices, provide that advice, and then the minister will make her decision.
I've been struck from my current vantage point by exactly the same thing. Almost by definition, if an issue of substance gets to the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs or the Minister of Foreign Affairs, it's a hard issue with no obvious answer. And so I just completely agree with what you say, the quality and the thought behind options presented. And often there are three suboptimal courses of action, all with consequences that you actually don't want. So the art of choosing between suboptimal paths certainly requires us, I think, to do our very best in being certain we've given things the thought. But most days, I think, boy, I'm glad it's not me that has to that has to take that decision. Well, Kumar, I could talk to you forever, but we're bumping up on time. So let me just say thank you and good luck in your upcoming year.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.